World Academy of Arts and Sciences, Rhian, who will be 89 this July, has been a major influence in the social sciences for over 60 years. Social anthropologist, sometimes refers to himself as evolutionary anthropologist, Douglas Fry, has been on our show several times. He is professor and chairperson at the Department of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. Before that, he was professor and chair at the Department of Anthropology at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. And before that, he had a unique opportunity to see what a somewhat different culture was like, as he was and is still affiliated with Docent at the Department of Social Sciences at Abu Akademi University in Finland. His research interests have been in conflict resolution, aggression, violence, and war, peacemaking processes and peace systems, peaceful societies, human nature and peace, and applied anthropology. He's the author and or editor of 9 texts, including Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace, and a new book co-authored with Rhian Eisler, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Minds, Lives, and Future. And welcome back to Equal Time for Free Thought, Rhian and Doug.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here, Barry.
So, as we begin, Rhian, it's been over 15 years, actually, I looked it up, since we've had you on the program, and perhaps not quite so long for you, Doug. But I like how you both opened the book, sharing your backgrounds with readers, up to how you came to write this book. Can each of you share some of that with us as we begin?
Really, as I write in our new book, In Nurturing Our Humanity, the theme of trying to figure out what are the conditions under which we can really thrive rather than barely survive, the conditions under which we can have a more peaceful, more equitable, more sustainable future. That theme is rooted in questions that arose very early in my life as a child refugee from Nazi Europe with my parents. And we barely escaped with our lives. And we were on one of the last ships to Cuba that was admitted before the St. Louis. That was a ship of 1,000 Jewish refugees who were turned back, many of them to be killed by the Nazis. And then growing up in the industrial slums of Havana, these were obviously traumatic experiences. And they led me to questions about whether all this cruelty, all this violence, all this misery is inevitable. You know, we're often told human nature, selfish genes, original sin, what have you, or whether there are alternatives. And it was the search for these alternatives that led to my research, to a new methodology I call the study of relational dynamics, which identified social configurations that really go beyond our conventional categories. And there were no names for them, so I called one the partnership system and the other one the domination system.
Okay, we will definitely get into the definitions of those so our audience knows what we're talking about. But first, Doug, what's your story, as you say in the book, that kind of takes you to this book?
Well, I find life just filled with wonderful coincidences. I remember when I was relatively young, much younger than I am today, that I was talking on the telephone with my father, and he had just gone to a lecture by, who said, a very interesting woman named Rhian Eisler, who had just written this book. And he was all thrilled and jazzed, and he said, as an anthropologist, you will really enjoy this book. So that was my first acquaintance, so to speak, with Rhian via my father having met her. And, you know, I still have that book that he passed on to me, and written in his handwriting in the front of the book is not Rhian's signature, unfortunately, but Rhian's telephone number of the time, with my father's little mnemonic on how to pronounce her name. So this is my father 100% to always reach out to somebody and make some connection. He was a humanitarian, and that certainly rubbed off on me in a big time. And that's one of the reasons I really went into anthropology, is, as Rhian was saying, you know, giving these big questions of how can we provide more equality for people, more social justice, peace, and the big word that starts with the letter P. How can we, as social scientists, scholars, humanists, and people from the humanities and so forth, come together to really try to apply our knowledge and our insights and our thinking to the real-world human problem. So it's a pleasure to work with Rhian on this book. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And it has been for me too, working with you, Doug.
That's a lovely story. I don't remember reading that part in the book, but I had to skim some stuff, but I like that story. Okay, so in many debates with my American friends here, conservatives or liberals, there's a tendency to get stuck in the details, meaning Americans like to have a detailed plan or else they tune out. But both of you understand the importance of systemic and big picture perspectives. Can you share with us why you think this way, why the big picture is so important?
I think that the big picture is something that we really need to definitely understand, especially in our today so interconnected world, interconnected not only by technologies of communication and transportation, but also by the threat of the decimation of our natural environment and the decimation of humanity through the use of these unprecedented powers of nuclear or biological warfare. So I started really always looking at the big picture because of my own experiences. Because I think that the thing that I want to talk about Doug for a moment here, Doug brings so much knowledge to this book in terms of how human evolution really started. And it started not, as we have been told, with this cruelty, this violence, you know. It really started with cultures that lasted for millennia that were more oriented to the partnership side of the partnership domination social scale. So that, again, is so important for us to know because the stories that we are told are big picture stories, like the story about human nature being flawed. That's a big picture story that we all carry. And this book, Nurturing Our Humanity, not only frontally contradicts that big picture story, but it also provides alternatives that are much more in sync with the evidence from science that we have today.
Doug, before you respond, it made me think of something else really quickly. When you've been on the program before, that's kind of what we focused on mostly, the Hobbesian view that we get from some of our neo-Darwinian evolutionary biologists like Richard Dawkins or Steven Pinker, evolutionary psychologist, which isn't the story of 190,000 years of human existence. It's the story of, at best, the last 10,000 years. So I just wanted to bring that up for the audience that this is a discussion we've had before as you answered the same question. And now I think finally there's been so much progress in social psychology and sociology and, of course, social anthropology that there should be no question anymore about what human nature actually is. But the narratives, they stay the same.
Barry, I think we talked after an edited book that I did, War, Peace, and Human Nature. It certainly bears mentioning, I think, in this context as well, where a variety of different scholars and scientists really focus on this question of human nature in relationship to violence and war, but also in terms of our potentials for peace, conflict resolution, and getting along. And Rhianne and I, in Nurturing Our Humanity, we certainly pick up that latter theme as well. You know, back to your question, though, about focusing on details as opposed to getting the big picture, it seems to me that this is not really a contradiction or a dichotomy. What Rhianne and I have done in the book is we really have drawn on a huge number of studies across a wide array of different disciplines, in other words, the details, the data, in order to make a larger picture or portrait of what's going on with humanity, human nature, and the need for shifting our patterns away from domination and towards partnership. And I know we're going to come back to that central theme shortly. But in my experience, it's really important to get into the nitty-gritty of the details, but it's also important to be able to step back with regularity and see how the different studies and what's coming out of different disciplines interconnect and support each other or sometimes contradict each other, which is almost more interesting because then you're faced with the question, well, how can this be? Why are we faced with contradictory facts and how can we expand our analysis or our interpretation to take that into consideration?
So let's get into the partnership studies question. Rhianne, can you explain your work in a little more detail with partnership studies? What do you mean by partnership cultures and how do they differ from what we have today, especially in the United States?
What we have today in the United States is a struggle, really, between movement towards partnership and in the midst of a massive regression to the domination side. And you'll see in a moment why I say this, that the struggle for a future really isn't between religion and secularism, east-west, north-south, right-left, because what these categories look at are just very, well, some of the details, you know, this part of the picture, what's the capitalist versus socialist, you know, what's the economic theory, what's the ideology, where is it located, etc. And most of these categories simply fragment our consciousness. Why? Because they leave out the majority of humanity, women and children. So that is huge. And I want to start by saying that we're all taught, especially those of us who had so-called higher education, that really matters relating to women and to children aren't all that important because, I found that one day I woke up sort of as if from a long drug sleep, and I realized that in all my years of so-called higher education, there had been hardly anything by, about, or for people like me, women. And there certainly isn't much about children, is there? The domination and partnership systems show the interconnection between how a society structures our primary human relations, yes, parent-child or caregiver-child, and gender relations, and our politics and our economics. And you can't see that if you don't include the majority of humanity. So to tell you in very shorthand the difference between the partnership and domination configuration, on the domination side, you have a configuration of top-down rule in both the family and all the other institutions of the state or tribe. Secondly, you have the ranking of the male form of humanity over the female form, and with it very rigid gender stereotypes. And with that devaluation and rigidity comes the devaluation of anything that is considered soft or feminine, such as caring, caregiving, nonviolence. And third, and we touched on that, you have beliefs and stories that justify all of this. And fourth, of course, these beliefs and stories also justify a high degree of socially accepted abuse and violence because they're necessary to really impose or maintain these rankings. And you find this configuration, look at contemporary societies all the way from secular Nazi Germany in Europe, which was rightist, or the leftist in the former Soviet Union, or you can find it in Kim Jong-un's secular North Korea, but you can also find it in religious societies, such as ISIS, the Taliban, and yes, the so-called rightist fundamentalist alliance in the United States. And for them, what is really fascinating, if we just pay attention to it, is a top priority is always the so-called, quote, traditional family, which is a code for an authoritarian, rigidly male-dominated, highly punitive family. And what we show in Nurturing Our Humanity is the neuroscience that really validates this theory about the importance of these primary human relations. Going to the partnership side of the social scale, and again, you can find this in the foraging societies that Doug has called the original partnership societies. Find it in some of the Neolithic societies like Chattanooga, where there was peace for 1,000 years, and there is no sign of gender difference, really, in the status of people. Or you can see trends towards that in our world today, in Northern European nations, Sweden, Finland, Norway, not perfect societies, but there is more democracy in both the family and the state or tribe. There is more gender equality, and the movement towards rigid gender stereotypes being demolished today, even here in the United States. I mean, if you look at the LGBT movement, the transgender movement, we're flexible in our gender identity. That's a partnership trend as well.
The Me Too movement as well.
The Me Too movement, very definitely. And the fact that when I say that the struggle in the United States is between the movement towards partnership and the domination, regression, and resistance, that's exactly what I mean. Because we're beginning to have some of these issues that so many people who think of themselves as progressive just think as women's issues or children's issues as really part of the mainstream conversation. That's very important. There is some violence. I mean, sometimes we almost lose it, but it doesn't have to be built into the system. And yes, as you see in the movement towards family support, towards paid parental leave, towards really caring for children, caring for people, caring for our natural environment, these so-called soft or feminine policies are not devalued. On the contrary, and we can talk about that some more, they are embraced by both women and men.
An interesting phenomenon over the last 30 years or so, I think, in the United States, at least with my limited scope, is that, like George Lakoff speaks about the differences between the rigid, dominant, male-dominated family, the patriarchy, versus more partnership type. He doesn't use those terms, but he just keeps it between conservatives and liberals. It was obvious for a while we would think we saw more of the dominance-based, patriarchal, nuclear family stuff happening on the right in the United States as opposed to the center or the left. There isn't much of a left in the United States now anyway. But lately, especially since election 2016, it doesn't seem to matter if it's, like you said, right or left or Republican or Democrat, whatever. This seems to be, as Marx called, the cultural hegemony. This seems to be what everyone believes, regardless of what they profess their political or economic beliefs are. Doug, I want to give you a chance to respond to this as well.
I spent nearly 20 years living in Finland, and Finland, as well as the other Nordic countries, are examples of relatively partnership-oriented societies. As Rhian pointed out, it's not an all or nothing, but there's a continuum, really, as we view it and discuss in the book, between domination on one extreme and partnership on the other. And, of course, societies can line up to different degrees along this continuum. But I think, you know, having lived abroad, first in Mexico and then later in Finland, not that these cultures are so very different from our United States culture, but in a way they are. And one critical way is the focus on cooperation much more than we do in the States. Now, every society, of course, has to have some level of cooperation. It couldn't be a society if it didn't. But what comes in, as I see in United States culture, which is a bit different from, I would generalize, to most European, if not all European cultures, and other societies and cultures around the planet to a large degree. Nothing is absolute, but what we see is an ability to think more about the whole and to consider other people and to cooperate and to not see things as so objectively divided as we do in the States today. So, you know, there's this adage in anthropology. I think everybody who's taken Anthro 101 at some point has heard, you know, that like the fish in the water, the fish doesn't know what water is. And although it's, you know, simple a concept, when we're in our own culture, we don't really see these elements, the values and the beliefs so clearly as if we go outside and look back. So this is, I think, one of the most interesting parts of nurturing our humanity is to look at some of the other non-Western cultures across this continuum of partnership and domination and use this as a way of then looking at our own United States culture and seeing how we're certainly not the norm. And beyond that, that there's other ways to be, which are much more partnership oriented. And therefore, that people tend to be happier in other national cultures, and I would argue in many other cultures, than we seem to be in the States these days. You know, overall, all generalizations are false, of course, but, you know, here I'm trying to take a bit of the big picture. When I first arrived in Finland, my very first impression was, oh, this is pretty much like the States. It's a modern country and things are moving. And the longer I was there, I understood the subtleties of some of the differences between Finland and the United States. And I talk about some of these anecdotes or incidences that occurred that sort of surprised me. But, you know, just to tell one here on your show, I first arrived as the American into Finland. I was going to be there for a year as a visiting professor. And I asked the immigration officer, I said, well, you know, should I get some private insurance in case I get ill or something? And she looked at me. I don't understand what you're saying. And I said, well, you know, if I have an accident, heaven forbid, or I get ill, I have to go to the hospital, should I get some insurance so that I will be cared for? And then she understood what I was asking, and she looked at me and said, of course you would be treated in the hospital. It would be inhumane not to treat you you know, it's such a short crystallization of a finished thinking about what's humanity and what is humane and what is the right thing to do. And like virtually every other European country nowadays, you know, they have health care that covers people from cradle to grave. And it's a much more caring society. It's a humane society. And it just boggles my mind. It really does. As I'm back here in the States now for 5-6 years, and all I've heard since I walked through the door is this ridiculous ongoing debate about healthcare and Obamacare and appealing Obamacare. And it's just, oh, come on, people. There's vested interests here. That's really the core of the thing. You know, where are our humanitarian values? We really need to put our institutions and our practices in line with our humanitarian values. If we have them, or else acknowledge that we don't care about other people.
That's exactly what I see here also. And I when we had you on the show once before, I was, when you said you were coming back to the States, to Alabama of all places, I was like, wow, that's going to be a culture shock indeed. But I mean, I wouldn't have imagined when I was growing up, I guess in the 70s or so, that what Bernie Sanders is trying to argue for, Medicare for all, or some form of universal health care, would be considered radical and socialist and all these trigger terms that people are using, Democrats as well as Republicans, in attacking what was basically, it's basically a very FDR mainstream, you know, let's take care of ourselves and each other ideology. It's so backwards now.
Talk about details versus the big picture. I think most thinking individuals step back and get out of the details in this case and just think about, where are my values? Do I care about other people, you know, or do I not? Do I want to live in a society where people are cared for, or do I not? You know, this is, at one level, you get so tangled up in, well, who's going to pay for this, and you know, where's the money going to come from, and the different subtleties of this back and forth. I think we could get grounded if we just looked towards our values and asked ourselves some key questions about what's ethical and what's humane.
Right, because if the smaller countries in Scandinavia can afford universal health care, the wealthiest country ever to exist on the planet certainly should. And that brings me, when you're talking about, well, caring about each other, to connections. As I got to chapter 3, my heart smiled, and I said, there have been so many books, mostly in pop culture, about the nature of love and what it means to be human as regards our interconnections. One of the better books I read recently, I don't know if either of you are familiar with, is Johann Harry's Lost Connections, which goes, you know, far beyond love, of course, but there are others. How do you see love and connection in your works outside of the obvious, which you just described? Rianne, you can go first.
First of all, let me say that the book is really basically a focus on what we're finding out from neuroscience. And what we're finding out from neuroscience about human development is fascinating. We have, for example, the ACEs studies, which adverse childhood experiences studies, which are very, very, very common, even in the United States. And I say even in the United States because in so many world regions, we have genital mutilation of girls, we have child brides, we have a horrendous violence against children, both male and female, etc. So I think that we should not just blame the West for this, because, you know, the cultures that you've talked about, actually the Northern European cultures, are Western cultures. They have moved more to the partnership side of the continuum than really any nations in the world, and we do find very much of the in-group versus out-group thinking, well, Shia versus Sunni, Sunni versus Shia in the Middle East, right? Here we've got white versus black, you know, the racism, but there it's based on a religious out-group, and it goes either way. So my view about this is that this, the partnership and domination systems, can be found worldwide, trends in both directions. But to get back to your question, Barry, about the importance really of what we are seeing today, about the importance of what I call caring connection. In that chapter that you like so very much, we propose that actually the emergence of love was central evolutionary emergence that had a great deal to do with the emergence of our species, which takes me straight to the neuroscience, because we know that the human being, our brains are far from fully developed when we're born. And what we know today, and this is why we introduce what we call the biocultural partnership domination lens, we know that the human brain actually develops in interaction with its environment, especially with what children experience or observe in the first few years before our critical faculties, our brains really, are there. One of the central themes of this book is that because we have left out of social analysis and social categories this very important aspect of human development, what happens in our primary parent-child or caregiver-child and our primary gender relations. We haven't been able to see that, for example, something that we also have in this book, and I'm going to jump into the political for a moment here because the two are inextricably interconnected. Mm-hmm. Some of the studies in this book show that there are some commonalities among the people who voted for this regression towards domination under President Donald Trump. For one thing, they seem to come from families. That's right, from families with very rigid gender stereotypes. But a very early study found that a commonality, the most striking commonality among Trump voters was that they felt anger towards what they considered uppity women, right? Women who stepped out of the stereotype. But even beyond that, if you look at some of the recent studies of politics, and very few still, but they're there, show that people who come from these domination families, this quote, traditional, authoritarian, male-dominated, punitive family, they will vote for punitive policies towards the out-group, you know, whether it's an immigrant, whether it's a Shiite or a Sunni, in the Middle East, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. They are deflecting a lot of their rage and pain to the out-group that the authority figure tells them is to blame for their problems, just as they were blamed for the pain that was caused to them when they were children. If we don't understand that connection, I did an op-ed in 2007 already for Alternate, and I said, look, there's something we need to learn from the people pushing us back, which is that there was a survey that I cited in that op-ed where people were asked, do you agree that the father is the master of the family? And the percentage of people jumped by 10 points in a decade. Why? Because the people pushing us back put so much focus on really pushing the norm for family back to the so-called traditional family. And yet progressives still tend to think of these as just women's and children's issues. And I can understand that, by the way. I mean, if you really think about it, out of 700 years of so-called modern science in the West, only 50 years ago did women's studies enter the academy, and then men's studies, queer studies, and they're still completely marginalized. And as for what we know from neuroscience about the tremendous impact on our brains, and with this then on how people as adults feel, think, act, including how they vote, that neuroscience is also so siloed. You know, if it's taught at all, it's taught in a neuroscience course, in a psychology course, it should be part of sociology, anthropology, political science. If we're talking about the big picture, people pushing us back have had an integrated political agenda, and we, on the progressive side, have not. And we've got to.
Right.
The confluence of caring and coercion is something that really leaves its mark. And I'm a little more sanguine than you are about the United States, because there is and has been for many years in the United States a movement towards partnership. I mean, from the days of lynchings in the South today, we can look at the current regression and say, yeah, it's horrible. But we can also look at the historical movement. The fact that the gender stereotypes are being weakened is very important, because look at the Northern European nations. Men vote for caring policies, not just women. This isn't a matter of women against men. You know, you were talking about matriarchy and patriarchy. Doesn't it strike you as strange that the language that we have been provided that's gender specific doesn't give us an alternative, really? Either women rule or men rule.
Right.
There's
it
no
should be parity.
There's no partnership, because we've brought up that way. But there is. The book, as you know, the last chapter deals with four cornerstones.
I'll be getting to that by the end of the program. I agree with you. I mean, it's, I guess, part of identity politics. It's either-or thinking, black and white thinking.
This is Dr. Joseph L. Graves, Jr., author of The Race Myth, a text that examines the social construction of race in America. Now, more than ever, we need equal time for free thought.
Right now, become a BAI buddy and support Equal Time for Free Thought. Right now, go to our donation site, give to WBAI.org. Then right at the top of the page, the first link on the top says BAI Buddy Monthly Donation. Click on that and you can sign up for a monthly donation of as little as 10 bucks a month. It's safe, simple, secure, and automatic. And it means so much to our keeping the quality programming that you've gotten used to here on WBAI on the air. Once you've joined, you'll receive a BAI Buddy card and a WBAI tote bag. The card allows you to participate in many member benefits, including discounts offered by our BAI Buddy partners. And if you prefer to sign up through a live person, you can call our call center at 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602, and tell them you want to become a BAI buddy. If you care that your progressive radio station keep the kind of free thinking we do here at Equal Time for Free Thought on the air, there's no better way to do it. Well, actually, yes, there could be if you could donate something like $1,000 in our name. But for average people who are working hard to keep it together, 10 bucks a month is like 33 cents a day. Please say that you could do at least that for keeping this station and this important program on the air. Again, please go to give to WBAI, that's give2WBAI.org, and click BAI Buddy Monthly Donation, or call our call center at 516-620-3602.
And you've been listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. We've been speaking with the authors of Nurturing Our Humanity, anthropologist Douglas Fry, and social psychologist, among other things, Rhianne Eisler. And now, back to the interview. We had a sociologist, Charles Durber, on the show at the time, who actually refers to, at least currently, the American current culture as sociopathic. I'm afraid there are so many examples that it's hard to argue against his hypothesis. Stress, loneliness have grown to epidemic proportions, and this is all part of the lack of connection and everything else that both of you were discussing. The cons of domination are all around us, but it's so conditioned that many of us don't even recognize it for what it is. Could you both share some of the effects of domination and how replacing that form of living with partnerships would change us, like in very real ways, not only culturally, but probably physically and psychologically as well?
This has been an interesting discussion here as I've been listening to you go back and forth. If I can may just comment first on a couple of things, and one is the idea of identity. You know, we're used to thinking very clearly about the us versus them. And as an anthropologist or someone with this cross-cultural perspective who also is given a lot of attention to conflict and conflict resolution, I really think that some of the answer here is to get beyond this dichotomizing of us and them. Identity can be played either way. And what studies from different societies show is that people can use their identities to construct the walls, or they can also use identity to make new friends and expand the group. And one sort of catchphrase that I like to use is we need to expand the us to include the them as a different way of looking at it. And if you really start thinking about how you relate to different groups and have different identities, every single one of us has what you could call a hierarchy of identity, which starts with our own family and goes out to the neighborhood and out to the community and then right on up. And some of us perceive ourselves as members of the human species, of humanity or being humans. And some of us perceive ourselves even broader. Another stretch to that one is members of the biological world as part of this ecosystem. So my point is that how we shape our identities, how we perceive ourselves, has a lot to do with how we get along with other individuals on the planet. And we listen with domination perspective to people talking a lot about walls, the divide, the us versus them. We better get the resources first or they will take them and so on. This is really harmful in any type of society. It's harmful at the global level, at the global society, and it's harmful within our local communities. So I just wanted to get this in that if you step back from this, and again, if you look at how people organize themselves across different societies, there is this tension. You can create in-groups and out-groups, but you can also create larger overarching identities. And here I'll link in some of my research, which is not so much talked about in the book, but I've been researching what I call peace systems over the last some years in cooperation with my students in large part and some other colleagues. And what we're discovering is when a group of neighboring societies don't make war with each other, there's different reasons how they manage to accomplish this. But one of them is to do exactly this, expanding the us to include the them, to have a different level of identification, which is inclusive. And it's not a matter of giving up, you know, your own identity as a member of a nation and those peace systems that involve neighboring nations, or giving up your identity as a tribal group or whatever culture you're belonging to. It's a matter of adding another layer of identification. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to slip this one in here. But I think it very much relates and is very important that we don't fall into this much propagated presumption, assumption, and speeches of those who would divide us. We don't tend towards this. And that leads me to my second point. You know, you mentioned in passing here the original partnership societies, the nomadic foragers. I think we, in the book, rather successfully and convincingly draw on two types of long time perspective. And one is to look back across our evolutionary heritage and make this argument that Rhianne was getting at with neurology. And I would add we can get at it by looking at primate behavior, which we also consider in the book to some degree, and also looking cross-culturally at nomadic foragers, this oldest and most simplest type of social organization where all humanity had lived in this type of social organization across our evolutionary past. And what you find very much in accordance with Rhianne's model of partnership is that in these societies, they tend to be egalitarian. That's really, really strongly impressed. So nobody is better than others, and they don't have social hierarchies that are really developed to any significant degree whatsoever. And the next level is that there's egalitarianism between men and women. Now, women and men in these foraging or nomadic hunter-gatherer societies often have different roles that they play, but they're not rigid roles. If a woman wants to hunt, well, she can hunt. She's not excluded from doing this, but in part due to basic physiology and evolutionary selection forces over the ages, you do get differences in what the sexes tend to do. It's a differentiation of labor or task, but you also get a huge overlap in what men and women do. And the most significant point I'm trying to emphasize here is women are not perceived as inferior, nor are men. They're just perceived as different, and they're all perceived as members of the group. And so if we look towards what is the neurological, long-term biological evolution and then a shorter-term cultural evolution overlaid and interacting with the biological set of evolutionary forces, you can make, as we do in the book, a pretty strong argument that partnership goes way back. And if you're going to say, you know, what really is the nature of humanity, it's much more geared towards partnership, although obviously domination is possible, and it's something that humans can adapt to. I don't mean adapt in a really positive way. I should probably say adjust to. And we talk about this in great detail in the book about the negative consequences in terms of the lack of love, the feeling of pain, the feeling of fear, the threat, the abuse, the terrorism, you know, which comes with domination. These are all negatives. You know, there's not much positive to a domination system as contrasted to what I would certainly argue is more the default or way that humans tend towards is partnership. You know, if you think about what would you rather do, go kill a bunch of people or go to a nice party? You know, that's an extreme.
Maybe that should be the slogan.
Well, and that takes us back to creating the conditions. I mean, the study of relational dynamics looks at, number one, what kinds of conditions work in a society either support or inhibit the expression of our human potentials for caring, for consciousness, for creativity, or ultimately, because we also have those possibilities, obviously, for insensitivity, cruelty, and violence. But it also looks at the relationship between the various elements of the society. And I cannot emphasize this enough. If you look at the rhetoric coming? I mean, who is the, in the United States, who is the major support for a regressive administration? It's people who believe what their leaders tell them, that this, quote, traditional family is the only possible divinely ordained and ordained by a very punitive male god, by the way. We have to really pay attention to what children observe and experience early on. And the good part is that there are trends today in the world to, number one, reveal the amount of violence and abuse against children and women, which is what really maintains domination systems in place. I mean, you were talking about capitalism, and I have argued and continue to argue that the issue isn't capitalism, it's domination economics, whether it was a Chinese emperor or it was a Middle Eastern Shah or whether it's an Indian Pasha or whether it's a feudal lord, and that neoliberalism, which is the form of capitalism that is causing so much grief in our world, is really just another version of domination economics, where those on the bottom are supposed to be content with the scraps falling, as in feudal times, from the opulent tables of those on top. But it does require looking at the larger picture.
So before we get too far down the road and run out of time, let's do discuss those cornerstones. As optimistic as some of our guests in the past try to be, it doesn't seem to come easy for a lot of people. Your final two chapters, The Real Culture Wars, and more specifically, A New Beginning, both discuss the age-old question, what is to be done. Could you discuss each of those briefly for us? I guess maybe you could take two each, if you like.
This is really Rianne's writing in this one, so take it away, Rianne.
I'll do a short, but I do want you to chime in, Doug, please.
Cool.
So the first cornerstone is childhood. And as we have both mentioned, and I love the way you said that, Doug, about the details, that there really is a question not of details, but of being siloed rather than interdisciplinary, okay? In our siloed universities, we are taught in such a way that it's very difficult to connect what we're learning in a political science course with what we're learning in a psychology course. So childhood, I mean, the neuroscience is very, very clear that what children first experience and observe is something that has an impact throughout life. Now, the good news is we can change. Many of us have changed. I mean, we have rejected domination practices that we were exposed to, but the majority of people who are exposed to these practices don't. And unfortunately, what we have discovered through, and I have to say that I was a pioneer in this, in including women's rights and children's rights into human rights, which is a relatively recent development, by the way, movement towards partnership. What we know is that there is a global pandemic of violence. Yes, violence against women and children. So the first cornerstone is really to listen to what pediatricians are telling us today, that what children need are caring connections, and that when there is this confluence of whatever caring children get with coercion, with rote obedience to what are often cruel and irrational rules, yeah, you're going to get what you get. You're going to get the deflection of this into against the outgroup, as labeled by whether it's Shia or Sunni or whether it's an immigrant or so. So the first cornerstone is changing and really taking into account what we today know from neuroscience about healthy human development and about the prevalence, as the ACEs studies show in the United States, of unhealthy childhood experiences and the core. But most of those studies, you see, have focused on individuals and on families. And what we do in Nurturing Our Humanity is we take this knowledge and, using the partnership domination biocultural lens, embed it in a social analysis. The second is gender. We've already spoken about that. And I have to say that when children, it's not coincidental, for example, that whether it's for Khomeini in Iran or whether it's for the Rightist Fundamentalist Alliance here in the United States or whether it was for Hitler or Stalin for that matter, that returning to the, quote, traditional roles of women, you know, getting women back into their, quote, traditional place is a top priority and keeping them there. Both women and men are taught this. So the movement towards changing gender norms is hugely important. And it's not only personally important, but socially important. Because what do children learn when they're brought up in a household where the difference between the male and female form is equated with either superiority or inferiority, dominating or being dominated, being served or serving, before their brains are formed, they internalize this template for seeing all differences. They're racial, religious, it doesn't really matter. With superior, inferior, dominated, being served, serving, that has to change. Economics, I wrote a book, The New Economics. It's called The Real Wealth of Nations. I highly recommend that book as well as Nurturing Art, because what is really happening right now, and you saw it in Davos, is that we are getting more and more recognition that we need an economic system that recognizes that the real wealth of nations consists of the contributions of people and of nature. So we need to leave behind both socialist and capitalist premises that caring for people starting in childhood and caring for a natural environment is just reproductive work. It is the most productive work. And especially in our post-industrial age, when that, quote, high-quality human capital, you know, economists keep talking about it's so important. We're talking about human capacity development. And it isn't just being a cog in an economic machine, okay? And, of course, story and language, which is what we're talking about. See, I think that what we really need to strengthen are the trends that are happening in all these four cornerstones and recognize, yes, the domination, really resistance and regression for what it is. If we have this integrated political agenda, just as the people pushing us back, you know, whether it's in Iran or whether it's here or whether it's in China, it doesn't really matter.
And that's what I was going to ask before we wrapped up. In any case, there will be, obviously, great resistance by many to doing what is necessary to address and realize the four cornerstones. So how do you both think we might get there from here? Are there any basic steps, or do we have to do this in leaps and bounds, or somewhere in the middle?
Well, a couple of thoughts there. One is really people power. I teach a class called The Power of Nonviolence, and in that class, we go through example after example from local levels to national levels of people throwing out dictators, and they do it nonviolently. And there's a wonderful book written by one of the people who was responsible for throwing out Serbian dictator Milosevic. And basically the country rose up in all sorts of nonviolent ways and got rid of this dictator. It's just one example of many. So to me, whether it's political action at the local level or nonviolent resistance at different social levels and the different social circumstances, this gives people hope, and it can be very effective. There's actually a relatively recent book out by a couple of political scientists, and they did a very extensive, detailed study, slip that in there, of looking at all cases of revolution over the 20th century. And they have hundreds of cases. And what they found out was that those cases of revolution that were nonviolent, as opposed to the violent ones, had more than twice the chance of succeeding in their objectives. And a whole lot of other pluses. And this loops back, believe it or not, to our consideration of human nature and what people find. I remember Erica Chenoweth is one of the authors of this book. And in a TED Talk, she points out, you know, if you're going to convince me to pick up a gun and kill people, well, you better really have a good argument, because that's dangerous and I might get killed. On the other hand, you know, everybody can bang pots to show their dissatisfaction from their balconies in unison at night and send the dictator a pretty good message that we're upset with you, totally nonviolently, and a whole variety of other nonviolent techniques. So this loops back as one mechanism or one way that I think people can implement change. Another one as an educator is I really think the importance of being aware and being knowledgeable about as many different aspects of what's going on in your society is really important. And I'm really dismayed by the amount of misinformation and fake news that is out there. It's just appalling. And again, this loops us back to the details and the facts, but not just the details and the facts by themselves, but again, obviously providing some framework. And I think Rhianne, with her scheme of a partnership and domination along a continuum, and also looping in now how this is integrated, we call it epigenetics, between biology and culture over time, it's a really important and innovative type of perspective, which provides the nexus for interpreting a whole variety of different disparate facts and information. Let me talk just a moment about economics, since that's also one of these pillars here, too. I found it for a very long time just surprising how effective whatever parties these are at not, well, suppressing the information that over 50 cents on each of our tax dollars goes towards military purposes in this country, mm-hmm. and has for decades. If you just stop and pause for a second and think about how all that money could have been spent on other absolutely necessary needs. We talked about health care, of course, infrastructure, there's education, there's reduction and elimination of poverty. All of these things are interconnected in a way. But what people in my studies show is that people really want safety and security. They don't necessarily want another aircraft carrier. They want safety and security. They want health care. They want shelter. They want clean water. So if you step back again from this and think about how we can make these changes, being aware and stepping back and thinking about this, and education is so important for this. Okay, I could go on and on, but...
the dominance-based ideology that's in our government and other governments is that safety and protection comes at the other end of the gun.
Right.
It benefits the people who are making money off of the military-industrial complex and wars and oil and all this other stuff.
I don't think it's more than that, Barry. Well, if you really think about what kinds of policies do we know, and we show this in Nurturing Our Humanity, that people who come from these domination families support their punitive policies, hard so-called masculine policies, rather than soft, so-called feminine ones. So there's always money for prisons. You know, what is that? That's the punitive male head of household, right, in domination systems. Money for weapons, for wars. That's the violent hero, right? But somehow there isn't enough money for caring for people, for children, for nutrition, for health care. And the thing that's so interesting in the Northern European countries that we talked about, Sweden, Finland, and Norway, there is much more gender parity. Women are about 50% of the national legislature. But it's not only that we know that women as a bloc, because we've been socialized for this, tend to vote for more caring policies, but that men, as the status of women rises, men no longer find it such a threat to their, quote, masculinity to also embrace these soft, caring values. But I really want to make that point because we somehow need to focus on the realities on the ground. And these are the realities on the ground. And speaking of economics, by the way, we are working on a new metric because as long as we use GDP or even the so-called GDP alternatives that look at quality of life, we are still not looking at what is necessary, which is social wealth. How much is invested in caring for people, starting in childhood, and how much is invested in caring for nature? And the social wealth economic indicators that we launched at the Center for Partnership Studies focus on that. And now we're converting them, there are 24 of those, we are converting them into one number. We've got the funding to do that. So if people are interested, you can find out about the social wealth economic indicators, which are the new metrics we need as a tool for shifting economic policy as well as thinking. Go to centerforpartnership.org.
I think the goals are laudable and the mountains are a little high, but maybe it isn't so difficult as some people think it is, perhaps because we've been conditioned to believe it's impossible when it's not. Thank you, Rhian Eisler and Doug Fry, for your important work and for being on Equal Time Free Thought.
You're most welcome, Barry. It's always a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Barry.
And you've been listening to Equal Time for Free Thought, today's show featuring Rhian Eisler and Douglas Fry on their new book, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Minds, Lives, and Future. If you missed any portion of this program or would like to listen to previous shows, you can find our archives dating back to 2002 at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Thanks again to our guests, Rhian and Doug, to today's engineer, to WBAI, and to all of you for listening. Until next time. Tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.
There are so many parts that I have.
This is Arnel Del Rey, and I'm very pleased to announce that WBAI is finally emerging from its existential crisis. We've recently achieved a settlement with the Empire State Building, and we're well on our way to a sound financial footing. It's with this in mind that I'm asking you to become an important part of this turning point. Our plan is to shorten our fund drives by asking our listeners to commit to a small monthly contribution that, collectively, will make all the difference. For as little as $10 a month, you can sign up online to become a BAI buddy and become an ongoing part of an esteemed cultural institution which has never backed down from the struggle for social justice. While many people might not even feel a $10, $15, or even $20 a month donation, to this station and to Equal Time for Free Thought, it's everything. Every person connected with Equal Time for Free Thought is totally volunteering his or her own time. All we ask is that you help keep the lights on with this small but significant act. Go to WBAI.org, and right near the top of the page is where you'll find a link to become a BAI buddy. You can become a BAI buddy using either a credit or a debit card. It's safe, secure, simple, and automatic. When you sign up, you can make your donation in the name of Equal Time for Free Thought or any other program that you want to support. And once you've joined, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a WBAI tote bag. The card allows you to participate in many member benefits, including discounts offered by our BAI buddy partners, such as Zipcar or the Museum of the City of New York. Most importantly, you'll know that you are helping the unique programs that you value here on WBAI stay right where they are. For Equal Time for Free Thought, this has been Arnel Del Rey, and I thank you for your support.
Once every 10 years, America mounts a census and attempts to count every single person living in the country, citizens and non-citizens, immigrants, documented and undocumented alike. This is an extremely difficult goal, even under ideal circumstances, and even as the actions of the current U.S. government has created fear and uncertainty that all but ensures that many immigrants will stay in the shadows, too terrified to risk contact with any governmental official, census takers included. However, by law, namely Title 13 of the U.S. Code, the Census Bureau cannot release any information about you, your business, or your immigration status to law enforcement. So step out of the shadows, stand up and be counted. This is a public service of WBAI Community Outreach.
The Pacifica Bylaws referendum is underway. February 18th is the start of the balloting phase, and all valid members will receive an e-ballot, paper ballot, or postcard with unique voter ID and PIN to cast your vote in favor of or against the proposed bylaws. Reduce quorum for voting from 10 to 5%. This includes votes to sell Pacifica property. Proponents state that 10% quorum risks quorum failure and resultant inability to avoid bankruptcy. Opponents state that low quorum means an unrepresentative few can destroy everything. For more information or to contact the election supervisor, visit elections.pacifica.org or leave a voicemail on 510-931-7504. All ballots must be received by March 19, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in order to be counted.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Please do visit us online and consider becoming a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. Become that sustaining.